Welcome to episode 29 of the Amphrizoology podcast. And today we're going to discuss grief more generally, including how other than human animals grieve, but with a focus on how researchers also grieve for their participants and interlockers and potentially vice versa. So I'm Chris, and my research focuses on cat-human relations and discourses surrounding roaming cats.
Hi, I'm Sarah, and I'm looking at shark-human relationships. And I'm also interested in the abandonment of more than human animals, specifically cats in Saudi Arabia. And I'm a PhD candidate at the University of Exeter.
Hi, I'm Michelle Sidlowski, and I study pachyderm-human relationships and how humans impact the conservation of species through those relationships.
And today we're also joined by Irene. Hi, Irene, a fellow researcher from the University of Exeter. So would you like to just introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your interests?
Yes, I'm Irene, and I'm just starting my PhD research at the University of Exeter, exploring modern human grief.
I was going to say, is it possible to start off with some understanding of any definition or definitions of grief? I'm assuming there's not one, there's probably many. Is it something you've come across, Irene?
I think it depends on the context, really. So I think there are several different definitions depending on perspectives.
One of the definitions or one of the ways it could be understood in an article called Why Mourning for Minks Matters, Rebellious Grief as a Practice of Solidarity, was described as grief being able to be understood as a destructive emotion which questions the current understanding of normality. And I thought that was quite an interesting way of putting it. A destructive emotion was definitely something I think we can all understand, and we can understand being applied to more than human animals.
But it does imply a negative connotation, the way I understand it. So I think that grief is really tightly linked to loss. So we don't, it isn't always about death. So forced relinquishment, loss of habitat or a natural environment, loss of a relationship. But yeah, grief is that sense of loss.
I'm wondering, and I haven't researched this, but I'm wondering if grief can also be linked to lack of control about losses. When we see losses around the world, when we see the loss of other humans, other more than human animals, and we are unable to make any effect, even though we feel empathy and we feel some kind of want to partake in improving situations however we can. And I'm wondering if there's some kind of grief associated with that. Specifically, I mean, we've seen so many things going on fairly recently in the human realm, but also in the loss of biodiversity and the deaths and suffering of more than human animals. Has anybody come across any link about grief to that kind of context?
Yeah, the grief in the Anthropocene, and how the active state of mourning as well, so that mourning actually becomes proactive and it becomes a political thing that can help move on. So looking at mourning in a positive aspect as well as a negative aspect, which is what we tend to do. We tend to see grief and mourning as negative rather than something that we need to process and something that we can move forward. And as you were saying, you know, you can start to bring in a resistance to some of the things that are happening around us through that initial connection of grief.
And I think too, partially, it sounds like what you were talking about, Sarah, is this sense of ecological grief as well for lost species or declining species, especially those species that are linked to a culture intimately, like the, you know, Inuit experiences of grief for the decline in caribou and the effects that that's going to have on an entire population of humans, and a loss of culture and a loss of traditional ways of living.
Yeah, and going back to what Irene said, again, in that Why Mourning for Minks Matters, the author talks about how marginalized rituals of mourning and grieving when they're done publicly, even though they can create conflict within society, they end up going through the process of becoming unmarginalized and or more centralized. And therefore, when marginalized forms of grief gain public awareness, they also attain more social acceptance and legitimacy, which helps helps processing them more effectively. And I thought that was quite interesting. This author is talking specifically about Extinction Rebellion, which I'm sure lots of people have different views about, but that unacceptable, unnormalized method of mourning and grieving in a public space actually helps people to have positive, in some people's views, aspects of grieving, and basically help to transform us, help to transform the way that we grieve. And so the process of grieving, although it has its rituals and practices, actually is fairly dynamic. I think, as we can see with the grieving of humans about more than human animals, and the way that we're now recognizing more than human animals grieving other more than human animals.
Well, and I think back to what you said about the positive impacts, that was the same with the Caribou article, is that it sort of creates the opposite of that isolation that sometimes we feel with grief. And when you come together in a public way, it creates it becomes community building in a way that we start to realize we have political and ecological responsibilities. We realize it's okay to grieve together. It's okay to grieve in general.
And grief is unique in many ways, isn't it? Because every individual grieves differently, but we all understand grief in one form or another. And so there's an aloneness to grief, but a collectiveness to grief as well. And this is what I find interesting when we transfer this to our understanding of more than human animal grief. And to me, it strikes me that there is an aloneness with their grieving, because it's so often unrecognized. And through that, this recognition of more than human animals having the capacity to grieve, and therefore, how can we understand this better and how can we understand them better, I see as a link forward to getting a better connection with them, or establishing a better connection with them.
I wonder if grief is more prominent amongst social species, because everybody experiences loss, right? Whether it's loss of their home, loss of a food source, not necessarily loss of a person. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if there's been sort of much. I think most of the research is on companion animal species, right? Grieving or social species. But I wondered if you'd had any insight into that, Irene.
I did read quite an interesting article about free living horses and grief when one of the horses in the group became ill and died, and obvious grief from the one of their companions. And I think the more we look into it, the more these stories or narratives that we start to hear, they amass. We start to hear more of them. And certainly with social animals, you can really understand. With social animals, we can really start to empathize with other animals who live in social groups, and where that is important for them, how they would grieve for the loss of another. But I think your point about grief not just being associated with death, but with loss of a range of different factors that come into our lives. And those losses, those irretrievable losses, can have great impact. And I'm sure that's the same, you know, across species. So it's maybe something we don't think enough of, particularly with captive animals, thinking about how they're living and what they could be grieving for. And maybe we don't take into account all the different factors that could impact them.
It's really interesting that, because with my work with abandoned cats, one of the things that I wrote about was unveiled transition with abandoned cats, how they have to go through that change of environments, not only in terms of physical environment, but relationship environment, the members of the multi-species family that they might have lost. And I'm very aware that a lot of adoption of different animals, different species, because that's the way we tend to categorize them, doesn't take into account how many times animals are actually rehomed. And there's something that I want to explore further or write about is a recycling of cats. It's almost as if, as long as they've got a home, as long as they've got a bowl of water, as long as they've got a bed, as long as they've got a human, there doesn't seem to be any thought process with some rehoming facilities, how many times that happens. And the grief that those, I'm talking about cats here specifically, must go through is quite dramatic. And I think it's very prevalent in terms of the way that they respond. Some people don't realise that it actually takes them a while to settle down, or don't know the story, the previous story. And it's something that when we rehome cats, we try and get their previous story, try and say how it might be difficult for them to settle down. And many of the adopters that we have actually understand and say and recognise, oh, yes, they must have gone through this. Oh, yes, they must have gone through that. But I don't think that happens with a lot of adoption, or it definitely doesn't happen with all adoption programmes, facilities, institutions. I think it's something that needs to be thought about more from the animal grieving, the loss point of view, for sure.
Well, I was just going to say that I think it's, you know, really applicable to the elephants. I mean, we know that elephants grieve or mourn the dead and have a very strong sense of need to sort of explore bodies and bones and deal with it in their own way. But also, just back to what Irene was saying, you know, they also, elephants that are under human care in range states used in tourism or used in forestry also face that early loss of maternal herds. They are, you know, taken away from the mother before a normal time for them to be leaving. They usually go through a breaking process, which is of course very traumatic, and then they're essentially taken to a new stable with new people and new conspecifics, if any, and then thought that they should behave in a way that is expected, right? And so I think that there's this complex PTSD, you know, as Bradshaw talks about a lot, that, you know, they've been through trauma after trauma after trauma, and then they're being switched to a new place and forced to do new tasks and eat new food and meet new people. And we don't take into account that grief and fear and trauma, lingering trauma that goes along with that, right?
I think it's a really good point, that, and it makes me, something Irene was saying before, what made me think about not only disenfranchised grief, which we are all aware of is when grief is invalidated, but it's usually spoken in terms of human grief. It's like a double disenfranchised grief when, don't be silly, your dog's not grieving, or don't be daft, your cat's, you're not upset, it's just behaviour. That's like a double disenfranchised grief. But what you're talking about there is very close to something that I was kind of fascinated by recently, which is, it's criminalised grief. It's very clear. So in terms of human criminalised grief, in Corset, there's an interesting article which we can put a link to in the references, which talks about grief in incarceration institutions where, because it's such a controlled environment, people are pretty much forbidden to grieve, or if they grieve, they are, at least in this institution that this lady is talking about, there are repercussions that go with grieving. For example, there is more control put on you. You're going to suicide watch, for example. This lady was stripped. She was cold. She was basically, she was put in isolation, and she had to contain her grief so she was allowed back into normal society. And one of the other things that happened as well is when people tried to comfort her, her fellow inmates tried to comfort her with giving some of their food or giving, she used that as an example. Apparently that's called passing, and you're not allowed to pass your own items on to give comfort to another inmate. I'm sure it's got reasons behind that. But in terms of the elephants, it makes me think that although it's not necessarily a criminal, it is controlled. It's more than disenfranchised. It's controlled to such a point that there are repercussions for those elephants that grieve. And that probably happens a lot with many different animals in, if we term captivity in just for this podcast, in terms of any animal that's under human control, whether it be a companion animal or a zoo animal or a tourism animal that's kind of semi-free, like the elephants perhaps, there's an expected behavior and a disallowance, a criminalization is not the word, but a disallowance of grief, which is really interesting subject.
I think too, part of it is that, think about these social creatures, like and humans as well, that when you're grieving and you've been removed from your home situation and put in a place where you don't have access, physical access to conspecifics, and your species is very much a tactile species, not only do you have that grief of loss, but you also have, you can't be comforted, right? Because there's no one who can touch you. You can't be soothed. You can't be patted. You can't be held. So it's very much, I think, like you're talking about with the criminalization, is that there's just no allowance for comfort, right? You simply are left to grieve in solitary.
And that brings into, you know, early weaning, doesn't it, in so many species, farmed animals and so on, where you, that social bond, that mother-child bond is broken, and without any understanding, really. And I think, going back to the point that Sarah was saying, you know, this is such a massive subject that is so underexplored. In, you know, when we think about how we control such a huge population of more than human animals, without giving them the grace of recognizing how they're feeling, their emotional state, and the fact that many, many of these animals could be grieving and going through periods of quite prolonged mourning, probably. And we don't always know what that looks like, because we all grieve differently. So I've found, I'm involved with foster dogs from abroad, rescue dogs, and I find very often, initially, they are quite shut down, sometimes for prolonged periods. We're thinking about months. And that loss of the familiar, so loss of their cohorts in the shelter, the loss of the familiar, the loss of being able to show their normal behaviours because they don't feel safe. There's so many different aspects to this loss. And these are usually dogs who are lucky and they come through and they go on and they find good homes and so on. But there are very many animals who are invisible, who are faceless, who are not seen, who are going through this grieving process unsupported because it's simply not recognised, you know, in our dealings with any animals.
Yeah, what you're both saying makes me think of this idea of Judith Butler about lives that are grievable, which is obviously a fluid concept, because I think that sometimes we may think, even in human terms, I think we could probably think of our own examples, a life is grievable and then something changes and we either get it or we don't consider that particular person or class of people grievable anymore for whatever reason. She basically says ungrievable lives are those that cannot be lost and cannot be destroyed because they already inhabit a lost and destroyed zone. They are ontologically and from the start already lost and destroyed, which means when they are destroyed, and she specifically talks about war, but I think we can think of industrial farming, for example, nothing is destroyed. And if we go back to the, I think, Irene, you were talking about the whole raft of animals that are ungrievable. The factory farmed animals are definitely in that context. And you were talking, Chris, about companion animals. A lot of the research is done on companion animals and the grief that surrounds them, their grief or our grief about them. And so in terms of a life being grievable, she says there has to be three characteristics. And those characteristics, and I'm sure they're totally arguable in many senses, but she says they have to be irreplaceable. And the irreplaceability is not necessarily the person, but it's the relationship. The relationship that makes the person who has experienced the loss, we can use person in terms of more than human animals as well. So grieving persons who have lost a specific relationship who made them who they are. So it changes our identity, or it changes the person whose experience is grief identity. So one of the examples that I came across in Red Malm's So Sorry for the Loss of Your Little Friends article is that he looks at condolence cards and the way they're written for human loss and more than human animals. So the cards mention the lost companion animal as a pet, which intimates that what has been lost is not a unique individual, but someone fulfilling the role as a pet. So that's the first factor. The second factor is that loss has to have a transformative effect. Any attempt to stay the same after losing someone important is in vain because the relationality is no longer the same, which is very similar to one. An example of transformativity in mourning for minks is that it then becomes this positive thing because there's a political movement to actually make minks be seen as significantly ethical beings. And the last one is that it has to be embodied experience. So an example is the physical void when returning home, an empty house, an empty bed, or a ball or a leash left on the ground. So a grievable life has to have those key factors, and they become fluid, I believe. And I guess we can all think of examples of the irreplaceability and the transformative effect and the embodied experience, which is not tied to industrial livestock.
Right. So wouldn't you think, though, that anyone who cares deeply about more than human animals, anyone who cares about the environment, anyone who cares very, very strongly about species in general meets all of those requirements on a regular basis, right? Because I think it is personal and transformative. Every time I experience a loss or there's an extinction or there's, you know, populations that are declared sort of a doomed population of animals because they're too small to rebound, right? I feel like, especially anyone who's an ethical vegan, right? That because there is that personal sense of loss, I think that they grieve all of those losses, but they're all grievable.
Sorry, I was going to say, I think being grievable is subjective. Somebody who has a turkey for dinner is not going to find a turkey grievable. It's not a grievable life. and we don't all start from the same baseline, do we? Sorry, Chris, go ahead.
I think you just clarified my point there, Sarah. So I was sort of going to say that grief is, it's in the hands of the griever. So you can grieve a plant, you can grieve. The grief is real, and it's when society is saying that your grief is not valid, that's when you get disenfranchised grief, and the grief the individual feels is still the same. So arguably, whoever or whatever you're grieving is grievable.
Absolutely. And yeah, absolutely. The norms of society dictate what we as a society are to find grievable. And of course, each culture and country and laws are all different. They're all a big mishmash and overlaying. But yeah, we might find something grievable. And it's interesting because it's something that I've thought about. And Irene, as somebody who's a foster for dogs, Chris, you've seen, you know, lots of cat situations. Michelle, you've seen some horrible situations with elephants. And in my own experience, I've seen lots of suffering and death of cats in really bad situations. Not only cats, but mainly cats. And I find myself, now I've moved to a different country, that my level of being emotionally affected by an animal in need has completely changed. The bar is much higher or lower, however you want to see it. People are upset about certain animals. And I'm thinking, have I lost my heart? Am I hardened? Has the grief created this callus? Is it not able to penetrate? I'm not really sure if that's a survivability mechanism.
And that's a part of compassion fatigue, isn't it? I'd say that it is a coping mechanism. It doesn't mean it's a permanent coping mechanism, but it is a coping mechanism because as we've kind of alluded to already, that some grief we're not really able to express as we need to. We're not able to discuss grief, particular certain grief, the types of grief as we need to, or only for a short period of time. And if it's prolonged, we consider it to be that we're maladjusted or we're not coping or whatever it is. We're not really able to talk about these things and discuss them openly. And yet grief is something that we live beside almost on a daily basis. And certainly if you're working in rescue, it will be on a daily basis. And maybe as a society or in the societies we live in, we're not kind enough to each other to recognize that we are all going through these feelings in some form on an almost continuous basis.
Yeah, thanks for joining us, Irene. Join us next time on the Anthropozoology podcast
for a continuing discussion on grief with Irene.